There is one actor who got slapped by mistake because they should have been a slap which didn't hit, but the actor actually didn't, you know, quite calculate correctly, and actually gave a slap to the Hollywood actor who was not happy about it.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Game Engineering Podcast. Today I am joined by Alex, a game developer who worked for Quantic Dream, so the studio behind Heavy Rain and Detroit Become Human. Alex worked on motion capture tech, which they call in short mocap. We discussed the whole pipeline, from actors on the scene, through technicalities like software and file formats used, to final animation files in the engine. Alex has spectacular knowledge on this, and I'm happy he agreed to share it on the podcast. I hope you enjoy the episode. Tell me a little bit about how mocap works in general as a technology.
So mocap works by having an actor wear some what we call markers. So it's basically little balls of with reflective material on them. Often it looks a bit like adhesive or tape. So it reflects light, especially infrared light. And you put these markers, usually about 40 markers or so, on the actor in specific places, and then you have some cameras all around the place that makes what we call a volume, the volume of the capture. And each camera emits infrared light and perceives in 2D in their own little space each point of the markers, each marker as a point in 2D. And by knowing the position of each camera relative to one another and where the markers appear in specific places for each of them cameras, then you can have the software reconstruct the position in 3D of each marker and okay. Extract from this a skeleton that fits the actor's size and proportions, height and proportions.
Okay.
So this is all handled by the mockup software. At Quantic Dream used Vicon, but there are others like OptiTrack, for example, is a competitor. But Vicon is the standard usually for this kind of mockup. And yeah, they take care of all the math behind the turning the 2D points into actual 3D space coordinates and skeletons and
okay.
All that stuff.
Is it, you mentioned 40 markers on a person, and how many cameras for a given scene?
It depends on the cameras and the needs of the production. So for example, for Detroit so the previous game from Quantic Dream on which I didn't work on, but I arrived just afterwards, they had the facial capture they did. So they did mocap for the face. They had some really small markers that worked just the same as the ones on the body. But they were a lot smaller, and they moved a lot, really little. Some markers really moved, didn't move quite a lot. So they needed a lot of resolution of the cameras for it to work. So there was only a little volume in which the performance capture, so the face capture, worked, and we had a lot of cameras just for this, with a really high definition, and we had about 80 cameras or something just for this, so it could work.
80 when cameras catch facial features, yeah. Moving.
But nowadays we don't do it like this. We do it with a headset, you have a headset over there and a camera there, visual normal camera, RGB camera. And which is going to film your face during the whole process. And so we don't have to put markers on the face, actually infrared markers at least, on the face. And so we don't need the same resolution, the same definition for the cameras. And so when in the new volume we set up afterwards, we had some new cameras that had actually a lower definition. So it actually doesn't, because we don't need that kind of definition anyway, because the markers are quite big. And we had that for this about the same volume, I'd say 25-30% less cameras, so about 60 cameras was sufficient for the capture.
And when you say volume, you mean like a scene with painted like green screen things, backgrounds, or what?
No, it's the volume. It's basically the whole. It's a hangar. It's a big place which is trapped actually by cameras 360 degrees around, and the volume is just the place where you can be, where enough cameras are going to see you, so that you can actually make the 3D reconstruction of the position of the markers.
Okay.
And this is the volume capture. But there's no green screening or anything. Everything is digitalized afterwards. And so every little movement or position of the actors are captured. So a lot of actors are actually comparing mocap to theater work, where the audience can always see the whole of your body, basically, which makes for a fuller performance. Whereas in film, if you have a close-up shot of your face, just like we do there, then you only have to focus on your face acting, and you can do whatever you want with your feet, for example, because you won't see it in the final shot.
Yeah.
So it's an approach to acting which is a bit different in that regard.
Yeah, I've seen, I think, short clips of a mocap actress walking and doing different styles for the same animation, showing how different she would act for the cartoon game, for like a little bit more expressive, like not a little bit more, extremely highly expressive movements for the cartoon parts. It would be different for the film parts, for the movie parts.
Yeah.
And mocap, is this, if you act in the mocap parts, do you need to, you were mentioning, you compared this to theater. So these sensors, these markers are, and cameras are sensitive enough to catch your very little movements, or you need to make it more expressive for the mocap, like, because the actress seem to switch between the styles based on the outcome, based on the movie that they're shooting for. I would imagine that if your sensors are sensitive enough, you could just act, or is it not the case?
So the mocap I described was it's called optical mocap. In a position with, let's say, for example, mocap with you have some gyroscopes and accelerometers on your body. So there's a company that does that. That's called X-Sense. And you have a few captors like this, and just because knowing the acceleration of your body in specific places, they can know a bit how you move. And this is quite useful because you don't need the whole camera setup, but it's because you have some drifting and you have to make some approximations based on where you started, all that kind of things. It can be less precise. But with optical mocap like we do, the definition of the resolution of the cameras is good enough that you can actually get some really tiny movements of the actors, and so they can act normally. They don't have to exaggerate anything, and you can get some really. It's actually a good reason to do mocap. It's because we get what we call some high frequencies in the movement of the actors. So when we move naturally, we actually have a lot of little movements or reactions or corrections in our proprioception and movements and everything that is makes it really realistic, but it's difficult to pin down how to recreate it by hand. And so mocap is really useful to preserve, to get these high frequencies out of the box from an actual person moving, to get a really realistic rendition of the animation, which would be difficult to do by hand.
I think you mentioned before when we were talking that you perceive mocap as a substitution for hand crafting animation, right?
Yeah.
Is this okay? And this is why. Okay, I feel like, yeah. And you mentioned that this can be quicker than just doing the animation beforehand. So
it depends. It depends completely on the context. So have you seen Arcane, the show, League of Legends show?
Yes. Yes.
Beautiful, beautiful show, done by a French studio actually.
But this was mocapped? This was
no, this was okay. Not mocapped at all.
Okay.
This was because the animation, the cartoony bit characters, yeah. And the animation was really stylized, and so for that kind of animations, you do not need some realistic movements, because you're not going to keep any of it. It's not interesting for the kind of actions that you need or that you want. But when you want to actually have some realistic animations, then it can be quite a hassle to do by hand. And so doing it by mocap can be quicker. It's not necessarily less work, but it's a workflow that lets you keep a lot of the lets you get a lot of a raw real performance from an actor, and just, you know, iterate a bit of it, tweak a little bit of it to get something just right. And if you do that correctly, then you can produce a lot of animations, realistic animations, really fast. But it takes a lot of work to get there, but it's doable, but it's specific for, it's just another way to produce animations.
Yeah,
which
let's talk,
fits realistic animations, yeah.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about how does it work exactly to produce those animations. So can you tell me a little bit more about the process of the pipeline?
Sure. The first step of a mocap pipeline is planning. So even if we're doing some shootings for our own games, or if we're doing some external client shootings, then we always need some planning, and to know who's going to be there, what are we going to shoot, in what order, and that kind of stuff. So there's a big planning phase first. We also have to make sure that if you're going to need some assets for, you know, having a 3D real-time reconstruction of the action, or maybe in-engine and that kind of stuff, then you have to make sure that these assets are ready, or the location in which you're going to shoot in 3D is ready. So this is a planning phase, and then you get to the shooting phase, where you actually have captured the data with the directors on the set and everything. And then there is it's an exporting phase, which you're actually going to clean a bit of the data, select which data you want, because you may have shot, maybe if an actor missed their line, for example, and you're gonna make a new take for this specific line, then you just have to specify if this is a good take, and export this data specifically. And there's all this export thing that actually creates some FBX files, what we use directly, FBX files in our pipeline, Country Dream. Most people do. And then this XPX files is a skeleton, the skeleton of the actor that played the scene, but you probably don't want the actor in the game right away. You want actually a 3D character that, you know, might be completely different from the actor. So you actually have to do a step called retargeting, so that the skeleton of the actor drives the skeleton of the actual character you want in your game, and then you can have this animation in your game. And that's
can we linger a little bit on this? So you're saying that the skeletons of the actors, so like points in the body, right, and the arms and legs, mm-hmm. they are not usually mapped one to one to the skeleton in the game for a character.
No. No, okay. Not necessarily. The hierarchy of the bones may be different because we used Vicon software for capture, and they have their own skeleton. But we do not need the same bones, or we maybe want to rig our characters differently, or there's a lot of reasons to have a different structure. And even the proportions of the height of the character may change. Maybe I'm a 175 tall dude, but we might have decided to have our characters that are 170 and 180 only. So okay. even if we have the same hierarchy, skeleton, and the same bones and everything in 3D, the simple fact that we're not the same height, I'm not the same height as the characters I'm playing in Engine, means I'm going to have to be retargeted, so that maybe when I have to walk 10 meters by myself as a 175 dude, tall dude, then my character actually walks 10 meters as well and doesn't go maybe 12 meters away, okay, or that kind of stuff, because okay, he's taller, so he's going to make, you know, longer steps.
Okay. We were at retargeting. I interrupted you there.
Yeah, retargeting. This is a step called retargeting. It's not specific to mocap. It's an animation process, because you may want to, maybe even if you do keyframe animations, you may want to recycle them on different characters of different sizes. So it is an animation process, not specifically a mocap process, but all mocap processes do some retargeting at some point. And then retargeting is usually done in, it can be done, we used to do it in Motion Builder, but it can be done in Maya, for example. But it could also be done in Engine. Unreal, for example, has some really great animation blueprint libraries that can do a lot of things really, really great for retargeting. And I heard that more features that way are coming up in the next iteration of the engine. So it really depends then on your workflow, how you want to get them animations into the engine. We had a custom engine, so we went through Motion Builder, then Maya for some tweaking, then we exported them in a private proprietary format. But you could, if you use Unreal, for example, you may not even go through Maya. You could just basically export your FBX into the engine and be done with it.
Okay, and once you retarget the animation, you export them and you have them inside your engine.
Yeah.
They are already prepped for they're retargeted, so they're prepped for the character, the model that you want to use, and you're pretty much done. So
that's the end of the mocap pipeline. Afterwards, there's probably a lot of more work to do, but if you've done animation through mocap or keyframe or whatever else, then it's not going to be any different for a game builder or for integration to use any other type of animation. You don't implement or you don't integrate or mocap animation differently than you do keyframe animations. You just get your file and use it wherever you need. So this is where my job ends as a mocap pipeline engineer.
Okay. And you mentioned that these shootings are like the scene for the volume. There's a scene and you can walk by 10 meters and things like that. There are also this type of animations when, for example, there's the idle animation that needs to be looped, or like a walking animation, and these needs to repeat. So I've seen short clips of people just walking on a treadmill with the markers. Yeah. Is this the thing also to do those?
You could do that if you have a limited capture volume, probably, but we didn't. We had enough room at Contig to let people walk normally. Now, these kind of animations for the walks and stuff is often implemented in quite differently from cinematic animations. So usually the walk cycles and that kind of stuff are going to be used as a way to react to inputs of the players. And so what we have for this is you can implement things like motion graphs or motion matching, which are ways to actually select from a library of animations and poses and that kind of stuff, the animations that fit the closest the input of the player, and merge them together so that you get a realistic animation from it that fits the inputs. So because you can't plan for every input that the player is going to make, so you have to develop a way to merge animations together to kind of have something that matches.
This is in engine, right?
This is done in engine, but this means that the library you create is really important for the quality of the final animation that is going to merge some of them together. So what we did, and what a lot of studio do for gameplay animations in mocap, is some standardized shoots where you're gonna ask an actor, for example, to walk straight forward, then to make a 45 degree angle with the right foot, then the left foot, then a 90 degree angle, or you know, have an idol where they just stand like this, then turn just 90 degrees to the right, then 90 degrees to the left with each feet, etc. And so this gives you like a whole library of animations for specific directions and stuff. Then it's in runtime in the engine, you're gonna merge all of these together to fit the inputs.
It must look super weird for the actor to like, can you please stand? Okay, you stand nicely. Can you please now turn around?
They understand the need. It is a technical job after all, so they understand. The hardest part for the actors usually was when you had to do crouched animations.
Okay.
Because then instead of just walking, you're basically squatting all the time. So you're, which get pretty heavy on the legs, and you have to walk in all different manners and do little spirals or that kind of stuff, and it can last maybe, I don't know, an hour and a half, 2 hours a shoot.
Oh, because you're saying that the same things that you do for walking animations, like turn around, go look left, look right, and things like that, you need to do the same for the crouching part.
Okay. And so you're basically squatting nonstop and walking, squatting nonstop for 2 hours, which can get the actors quite tired, of course.
Yeah.
So this is a rite of passage for new stunt people that are going to do these kind of runtime animations.
Are there specialized actors for doing the mocap things, or is this like a sub category for actors?
It's difficult for me to say because I wasn't working with the actors directly, so my answer might not be the best. But there are actors that are definitely specializing in mocap, though there's always a big overlap between mocap actors and real live action actors. I think it's Neil Newbon, who's done Astarion in Baldur's Gate, also has done Kamsky in Detroit. This guy is a live action actor and voiceover actor also, but he specializes a lot in mocap. He does. He gives some lessons to know how to work within mocap volumes and that kind of stuff. So there is a lot of technicalities to it. Though people coming towards mocap are not, they're not. They've trained to be actors as a whole. They've not. Yeah. They trained to specialize into mocap, but they stunts people as well. I mean, we had the guy from who was a stunt man for Daniel Craig or something, who came working on Detroit. So the stunts people always do some live action, normal, traditional work, as yeah. well as mocap. It fits perfectly.
Okay. And you mentioned the scenes, because I now realize that if you're shooting a scene and you yeah. need to have, let's say, chairs or things like that, like obstacles, it's not yeah. just an empty scene where people walk around. They have mm-hmm. things. So then you need to map this scene to the engine scene and make sure that these stay in yeah. sync, right? Like yeah. It seems messy. Like, it seems that a lot of things can go wrong. How do you make sure that there's all
a lot of things can indeed go wrong? Yeah,
a lot of things do go wrong, probably. Yeah. So, how do you make sure that all the objects are in sync, in place, or things like that?
So for the placement of the decor or the assets around that, if you're not going to interact with them, because you can track actually objects. If you have like a weapon or something, you can put some markers on them and track them independently of the actors. So this is one thing. Now for the rest of, let's say you have maybe a couch on which you sit on, or maybe you're in a car or something like this, then what you're better off doing is actually having a 3D reconstruction of your level of the set in which you're going to shoot, and check that when the actors sit in there, they or maybe move along the level, maybe they just make sure that they don't, you know, hit their head on some low hanging lamp, or don't go through the I don't know, the tables or the bed or whatever. So this is really helpful. That's why actually you can have you have plugins for Unreal and Unity. I think you can actually stream Vicon directly into the engine. So you can say, this is where we're going to shoot, and the whole set of your actors is actually in engine. You can see how they move around in the engine, and you can actually already post-process a bit of it, like for their feet to match the ground and that kind
of
stuff.
That's super cool. I think that's super. Yeah. That's probably super useful for this.
And this is why planning is really important, because you need to know where you're going to shoot in the set, in the level. So you can actually, what we couldn't stream the mocap directly into the engine. So we actually had to make a cut from it. Make a cut from this, and to have it in a Maya or Motion Builder, and actually shooting this. And the props people from the mocap team actually made some measurements in 3D to know how it should how to set up on the set, on the real set, live set, where they should put some boxes and that kind of thing.
But they made measurements, but from the engine,
like, yeah. Basically, the FBX file of the level would be in Maya, and in Maya you can make, you know, measurements in centimeters. Okay. Like, okay. They have to walk in between, I don't know, a small opening. How wide should it be? Well, it's 50 centimeters in the engine, so we're gonna set it up in 50 centimeters on the set.
Okay, that's a lot. Yeah, so I can see where motion capture animations can be faster and quicker in general, but the preparing the planning phase and preparing yeah. the scene, the set, for this one shot, somebody like walking through here and jumping there, things like that, this seems to take enormous amount of time and preparation effort to just have it done and ready.
Well, it can, it depends on the complexity of the animations you're trying to shoot. It's definitely not easier to do, because it can be quite, it is a really complex process. But for shoots that weren't as complex as this, that were basically, you know, the standardized animations for runtime systems, they are really easy to shoot because you're not in a specific level and you know exactly what you're going to do and in what order and everything. So it's just, what do we need? Well, we need to shoot the walking cycle for that kind of character. All right, we just plan it on that day with a stunt person and we're good to go. We basically have nothing to do. For this kind of shoots, which maybe, I don't know, maybe 90% of the shoots are not a lot more complex than this.
Yeah.
Well, you could have a few hundred animations that are shot in the morning and that are ready to be in engine in a rough state. So it's not all really clean, but it's really, really usable. By the end of the day, you could have them.
A few hundred in the morning.
A few hundred animations.
Because
maybe you have, I don't know, an animation, I can't dream, an animation was like a character moving or a prop moving. So yeah. Let's say you have two actors drinking a beer at a bar, for example, then you'll have four animations for everything they say. We'd have four animations because we'd have two for the characters and two for the props for the tank cards or whatever. So it's four animations that are needing to be produced. And maybe if one says hello, the other says, how are you doing? I'm fine, and you, thank you. It's actually four times four animations because there are four. Okay, so it goes up quite fast, but it is still needing to be produced in a way, and the resolution can be quite high. And this is how in a single morning you can have hundreds of animations that are produced.
Okay. And when you mentioned now that there are two people at the bar and they have their animation of like having a beer, drinking it, and they're also talking, are these separate animations or they are in one, like standing and the full body and also talking, expressing things on the face?
It depends really on the people doing this. At Quantic, it wasn't really a solved issue because we tracked our animations like animations shot together should be together in engine. But the facial animation were tracked differently as the body animations, and the sounds are also tracked a bit differently. So it was a bit of a struggle to mix it all together neatly, automatically. So it needed some hand tweaking and configuration for it to work properly, but basically in the end it's different animations in the engine for the body, because it's different rigs as well that maps to the same character but can be used and targeted differently. Different people are working on them also. You have some animators that are doing only body retargeting, and you have animators that are specialized in facial retargeting and animation because it is a whole different beast to do some facial animation. It is really difficult.
Okay.
So you have people working exclusively on facial animations.
So when you're shooting a cinematic and there are both scenes of somebody walking and then the close up on their face.
Yeah.
They have both markers on their full face. And let's imagine that we're using the latest technology. So we have a headset with a camera that tracks all the facial expressions. Yeah. So this will produce two separate animations, although they are synced, right? Camera from the face and the tracker is the
and the sound as well, because we it's not usually done in mocap. Usually you have you do a voiceover of your own animations afterwards. That's how it's usually done for because it's easier that way. But at Quantic we actually had a full capture that's been made, so what the actor says in their suit with the camera is actually captured as well, with a small mics on the headset, and reused for the actual voice lines. So it's actually three different files. We have two animations and one sound for the voices that we have to track and keep in sync to along the pipeline.
Yeah, keeping it in sync, it probably, yeah.
It is a shit show, actually. Handling, when you're thinking about tools, programming, and you know, you're thinking about maybe UIs to create, to automate some processes and math and that kind of stuff, but you don't necessarily think, okay, I now have to sync some time codes by the frame in different softwares that handle them differently, sometimes with different standards. And also there is a bug in that tool that sometimes takes off a frame, that kind of stuff. We also had an issue because, you know, you need to have some video reference when you shoot the animation in mocap. So the actual data is in 3D, but it's really useful to have some people using cameras on the set to just capture the action so that the animators, when they see the real stuff happening that's been captured with the actors in their suits and everything, it helps them to understand what happened better than just having, you know, skeletons moving around in 3D. So we actually, every shoot is actually captured like this also. It's actually filmed for reference for the animators. And this can be useful also to go frame by frame to know, for example, if someone hits a wall, to know exactly when the impact has happened. You need to be frame perfect, basically, with your mocap retargeting and that kind of stuff. And so video reference helps. But if I'm talking to you about this, is because we used to animate at 30 FPS. But the cameras that we've been using for reference for the animators were 25 FPS.
Oh, no.
And they were actually brought up to 30 FPS by duplication of one every six frame.
Yeah.
So you have one every six frame that is repeated, but not all cameras. So you have multiple cameras for different angles. Not all cameras have the same frame that is doubled.
When
the person hits the wall, then you might have one camera that stops there and gets a frame double, then hits the wall, and another camera where from another angle you get he first hits the wall and then this frame is doubled and it continues in sync. And then when you need to be frame perfect, but you don't know which frame of reference you need to take, it can be quite difficult. And this is issues that, you know, nobody thinks about. You wouldn't know it happens in any studio if you didn't have to fix it yourself.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah, that's experience. That's why it's difficult to gain experience, because you need to first run into problems, realize that there are problems that you didn't know about, and then fix them, and then probably go on to discover some more problems along the way. So you mentioned that not only you have more than a couple of files to make the animation from. So motion capture for the body, motion capture for the face and sound, but also for the animators to tweak the animations. You're doing the reference video with a normal camera of the scene. And a couple of cameras are doing this.
Yeah.
And animators sometimes need to tweak the files, the animation files, if something goes wrong, or they need to change to be precise, like frame perfect in the post-processing part.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's the thing that you would not think about when you're playing Detroit Become Human, for example. Like, that's the things that you're like, oh, why is this so weird? Like, why somebody's smiling like this way? This felt off, but I have no idea what happened there. I get so many things that go underneath and are not appreciated in the result.
But stunt work can be quite difficult because usually when you're shooting with on set, you have you can build something on the set to represent the actual 3D environment, but everything needs to be nothing has to be solid, because if you have basically a wall that you can't see through, then the cameras can't see through either. So you're going to lose a lot of data and precision. So everything has to be transparent in a way, to infrared. And the thing is, when you're doing stunt work and you have maybe a character hitting a wall, then you need to have a solid wall, because you can have a door. Just for the cameras. If you need to hit something, you need to hit it hard, and it needs to stay in place, so you're not going to see anything through it. And then the character maybe falls on the floor, and the floor, of course, is not see-through. So for a lot of the stunt work, you actually have a lot of markers that can get obscured in many different ways and displaced and maybe sometimes even lost. And then the mocap team has to figure out a way to export some good quality data with maybe only half the markers available, because he's lying on the floor or something like this. And this can be quite difficult. This can produce some artifacts, and which have to be then taken care of. It can actually remove some of the high frequencies I was talking about in the quality of the animation. It gets an animation that is more smoothed out. And so this is something that you have to prevent as much as possible, but you can't always have perfect capture of the data, perfect data. So you have to walk around it as much as you can and reuse, compensate afterwards by hand in animation. And so this is why you may have for different scenes a different quality of the overall data, because some events or some action may be more difficult to capture than others.
How is it for the retakes of the scenes? You're talking about stunt work. I would imagine that it's difficult to repeat over and over again the same stunt, which, you know, at some point will hurt the actor. If there is smashing the wall over and over again, it will probably be difficult for him to keep doing this. So, like, do you have to repeat the scenes a lot of the times, or because of the technology you kind of get the sensors in the one go and it's okay?
So you have more often than not multiple retakes to do, just for even for to be secure. If there is actually something you didn't see on set that breaks the animation, to have another one to use just in case. So definitely there are multiple retakes. Now, again, I haven't worked with the stunts people directly, but there is. When there's a lot of stunts happening, there is always a stunt coordinator, just like as in films, to help them not hurt themselves and still have some good quality data and shoots afterwards. And there's a lot of work going into having, you know, pillows and everything, just so when you ram into a wall, it's not a solid wall. I mean, it can tank some of the movement, but still you're not hitting a hard brick wall. And so, and afterwards, it's the job of the stunts people to, they know how to fall over, they know how to hit themselves without really hitting themselves, and they know a lot of stuff. And because it's part of their work to be able to make it look like they hurt without actually hurting. So it's I can't really go into more details on this, but it is a well-oiled machine of taking care of themselves while still making it look like it's fine. And usually there's, I don't think in mocap we really had people getting hurt. Actually, not the stunts. There's one actor who got slapped by mistake because they should have been a slap which didn't hit, but the actor actually didn't, you know, quite calculate correctly, and actually gave a slap to the Hollywood actor who was not happy about it. But it was quite funny because he was kind of an ass apparently. So
Was it then used as an animation?
No, because it was with the facial markers. So actually the slap took off most of the markers, though data was invisible. But the video reference is there and it's kept quite closely by someone. But in film you know in a real set you have to do, when you have to do superhero movie stuff, you actually have to do quite dangerous stuff, and you try to accommodate for this in different ways. But in mocap, it's like going to the gym, you know. Everything is standardized in a way for you to be able to do your best work without hurting yourself, actually, because it's so, we have a lot of control on what is happening. So, because everything is going to be digitalized afterwards, we do not care much about if you have some rig or if there is pillows on the floor or whatever. You just...
Yes. You're not recording the visuals. You're recording the skeletons. I keep forgetting that. I think that it's the outcome is mostly skeletons plus sound in your case.
Skeletons, maybe video for the face, sound, and skeletons. And there is, we do use some markers for the props, the actual props. So maybe if you have a weapon, a gun, then you're going to have some markers just for this, because there's no skeleton on a gun, at least not in mocap. Okay. But yeah.
Okay, let's turn a little bit into the software part. You mentioned already a couple of tools that you're using for the pipeline, and I'd like us a little bit to say a couple of words about them to know exactly what role do they play. So you mentioned Motion Builder, Maya, and then the engine. Motion Builder I'm least familiar with. Let's start with it. Like, what is Motion Builder and how does it work in general?
So Motion Builder is a... is an animation software by Autodesk. So it's the same company behind Maya and 3ds Max and AutoCAD and that kind of stuff. And it has been designed for animation. It's a tool that is quite unique because it hasn't changed that much in more than a decade. Which actually really, it doesn't actually help for the scripting part when you have to work within it to build software upon it. It can be quite difficult because it is finicky and it's buggy and it's the documentation is really bad. So it can be quite difficult to do a lot of stuff. For me, it was hell to work with. But animators love Motion Builder because it does less for, you know, Maya, you can do rigging, simulation, you can do modeling and that kind of stuff. You can't do all of that or most of that in Motion Builder because it is designed for 60 FPS or 120 FPS animation and that kind of stuff. And the tool set there is in Motion Builder is quite unique and really had, I don't know, it hasn't been replicated yet in any meaningful manner in another software. So animators keep asking to use Motion Builder. In fact, the Hogwarts Legacy game there, they used Unreal Engine, and they used mocap as well, but they used Unreal Engine, and Unreal Engine has some quite powerful animation tooling. But even though they had this, animators loved Motion Builder enough so that they asked to have a whole bunch of tooling into Motion Builder and do their animation and camera work in Motion Builder directly because of the tool set there is there that is nowhere to be found elsewhere.
Maybe it's a marker also of a good software, even though it's little buggy and it's difficult to build integrations upon it. But yeah. if it stays mostly the same for a decade, it proves something. Like
The motion builder team at a decade ago, something like this, had I think it was Soft Image at the time, before it was bought by Autodesk. They had a vision for they were psychics in the way of knowing how to what people needed and how to make it. So animators love this, and actually the new animation retargeting tooling that I talked about earlier in Unreal Engine coming up is actually some people saying to the Epic Games team, yo, can we have motion builder tools inside the engine? That would be great. And a year later, they go like, boop, there you go. We finally made it. And so, yeah, slowly creeps up towards motion builder, but it is still a piece of software that is really used a lot for animation purposes. And live animation purposes, so retargeting and that kind of stuff.
Okay, yeah. So motion builder, it's for animation and for like a proper animation, I don't mean proper, like the 60 frames or 100 frames, so not like the movie type animation. It's more like digital animation.
Well, yeah, it's basically the way it handles rendering makes it more efficient at having maybe a lot of characters. Maybe if you have a lot of characters working together in a scene, motion builder is going to tank that quite easily. But when you're doing the same thing in Maya, because it has to handle rendering and the actual data itself differently, because you can do so much more with it. After a few characters you add in there, it may lag at 40, 30 FPS. And which makes it a bit wonky to use for animation. So motion builder is never used really by itself, I think, for animation. Most people are gonna reuse the animation from motion builder in Maya for fixing stuff and contacts and a lot of things. But it is quite a powerful tool, motion builder, in the way that it allows you to work quite seamlessly with a lot of characters, for example, and with quite unique tools to merge animations together and that kind of stuff.
Okay, and Maya, what role Maya plays in the pipeline?
Well, I was at Quantic Dream. I was in a team called the Maya team because it was a tools team dedicated to the Maya software. So it's used for modelization, simulation of many, many things. Most of Disney's work is done actually in Maya, I think. So it has a rendering engine that is not real time, so we're not using it, but it has a rendering engine. It has a lot of features, rigging of the characters, skinning, etc. So it is used, it's a bit like 3ds Max, different, it's kind of samey softwares, but with different workflows. So it depends, when you're doing film or video games, people are more inclined for one or the other. But the thing is, in Maya, we actually had for Detroit, because the environments were quite it wasn't an open world. It was some smaller scenes, so everything was actually built in Maya. So our level design was done in Maya. Level art was done in Maya. Everything was done in Maya, and then so we had to be able to assemble our scenes when people were changing a prop or something and pushing it to version control. Then we had to be able to pull it from Maya. From version control into Maya easily with some tooling and that kind of stuff. And so the assembly of the scene actually was done in Maya and then exported into the engine directly. So this is, so a lot of the the core of the game was actually built into Maya first.
Okay.
And so that's why we needed a lot of tooling around this.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, now I get it. Because it felt that Maya team would be like, why would people need so many people working on Maya, like Maya yeah. tooling? But if you're doing the, let's say, level design there and scenes like that,
yeah,
it makes sense that a lot of
the whole of the game, except the gameplay, was probably done in Maya first. Well, there is some, even the VFX was placed around in Maya, and then actually it was exported in Engine, and then you do the lighting and post processing and that kind of stuff. But and of course the gameplay. But no, most of the game was actually first done in Maya, and we're actually moving away from Maya. We've been actually moving away from Maya because it can be a lot of constraints, and we don't want to stick around, be forced to use Maya for the rest of our lives. So a lot of the tooling was actually taken out of Maya itself.
Into what? Into Engine?
Into standalone stuff.
Okay.
So, for example, the representation of our game, so the structure of the animations with one another into the levels, all the props into, you know, there's a hierarchy to all of this. Well, we used to describe it using Maya nodes, and okay. now we, instead of using some Maya tools specific to Maya, we wanted to be able to reuse it in maybe other software, but basically like Motion Builder. I used this kind of description to redo the environment in Motion Builder directly, so we could have a one-to-one representation of what happened in Motion Builder and what happened in Maya and what happened in Engine. So we would be able to shoot in something else than in Maya, because Maya doesn't quite work as well as Motion Builder for this. So yeah, a lot of the work went away these past few years to extract our work from the Maya software, even though a lot of the teams there still work within Maya, of course.
And then for the file formats between Motion Builder, Motion Builder is from Autodesk, and Maya is also from Autodesk. And there is the format FBX. Is this a proprietary format for animation from Autodesk?
I think it is. It is developed by Autodesk.
Okay.
I think it is proprietary.
Yes, this one I'm certain. But author of the format, I did not know. So if it's probably from Autodesk, it makes sense that. That it's used between all these tools. So you stayed within FBX file format pretty much and for entire pipeline.
Well, through mocap, the mocap exports FBX that we process in Motion Builder, then export another FBX that we can import into Maya. But when we get out of Maya, we actually export to our engine, and our engine has custom proprietary format. So there is a conversion there. But if it was, for example, if you went for Unreal Engine using the same pipeline and we switched to Unreal Engine, we'd probably would have been FBX again.
Yeah.
For the day, it could have worked just like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it would be less work. Yeah. Is this, you don't need to answer this if you can't, but is the custom file format for animation, what was the decision for it? In the custom engine?
I wasn't part of that process anyway.
Okay.
Because I wasn't working within the engine. I was working for everything before to produce their files. And actually it's someone else from my team who was responsible of conversion of these data for the engine's data. So I really couldn't answer.
Okay. Let's turn a little bit more into like a retrospective part and tell me what are the most difficult parts of mocap and mocap work in general? Like, what are the hurdles or the difficulties?
I think the most difficult part of producing mocap animations like this is keeping people in sync, basically. So it's having people walk together in a coherent manner so that you can actually produce something. Because there's few other challenges that will need such diversity of people working together as a pipeline and a mocha pipeline at that. So we had to work with the producers, the directors, the writers, the mocap engineers, of course, the level artists, character artists, animators, and game builders, without even talking about all the other developers and coders for different tools and processes. So all of these people need to be in sync with each other and to agree with each other so that and do their work correctly with one another so that the actual data can be produced and be meaningful and be the one we wanted, we actually needed. So this is actually the most difficult part. This is working together. It's because there are so many different people that do not always speak the same language. They have domain-specific language and they understand things differently, and it's hard to name things in that regard. So it is, that is really difficult. When you have an issue and you have, I don't know, five different people from five different teams to need to find a solution, but they all have their own meetings and agendas and problems that are not related specifically to mocap, and you have to, you know, get them to agree on something. This is really, really difficult.
Okay.
Yeah. So
communication also.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of different groups collaborating on the same thing. And also, yeah, you know, like if you look at the game that is a big project spanning multiple years, you're producing mm-hmm. files, so it's like a state and you need to modify the state over time. It's very difficult to keep everybody in sync, what has been changed to these files and things like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, any lessons learned from working on this with this technology, like insights that you can pass on?
Well, to me, it is, even if it's really difficult, it is worth it. It is worth it to have such. I mean, the challenges you get when you try to do mocap like this is are so interesting, and it gets so much job done that it's insane how cool it is to work on mocap. I can't believe I left on my own accord on that job. It is really amazing to do some mocap. So even if it's difficult, it costs a lot and all of that. It is. So fun to do, and you get to work with so many talented people. It is an amazing experience. So, but it is a lot of weird technologies and understanding a lot of people. But it is the best experience I've had professionally is having to make the mocap work. Anything else is seems a bit dull in comparison. So that is the lesson I learned is that I want to, in a way, keep to it or get back to it in a way.
Yeah. And you're now headed for some more freelancing work on the game programming tools, right? Do you want to share more details about this?
Sure. Yeah. So the thing is, tools programming is about, to me at least, it's about making the lives of other people easier so that they can focus on doing the thing they do best when producing a game. And so what I'm trying to do right now is work on quite boring stuff, actually. So automation, testing of the games and features and that kind of stuff. So that actually some some other teams can, you know, profit from this and be have their environment be a bit safer, because it doing games is difficult. It is really hard, and it's easy to break stuff, and then you have to go to the Gamescom or to present your game somewhere, and you don't have a build because you don't know why, because you didn't do one build for the last 2 weeks, and then suddenly you have to do one, but it doesn't work, and then you have to pull an all-nighter to fix these issues. Even in game jams, you can have a lot of pressure doing this. So yeah, the job I gave myself right now, freelancing, is trying to work on something that will lift this weight off the shoulders of people doing the games they love, so they can keep loving doing games. And maybe one day I'll have, you know, enough time to do the games myself as well, because I like doing this. And working with people that do great games is really all there is to it. I mean, working with great people is what makes a job cool. So yeah, that's the plan.
Well, that's a great place to end, I think.
Yeah. Cool.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. It was great.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.